This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you very much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I am your host, Jim Irvin, and we are pleased to welcome Michael Rubin of the band King Falcon on the other end of our line. King Falcon recently released their debut self-titled album in late October, and they're also doing a little bit of a touring gig right now, actually going to be visiting Michigan and some other areas. The band combines indie rock elements with classic rock sensibilities, according to their information packet. Now, I can tell you after listening to the CD, I have definitely heard some classic rock touches throughout, tastefully interlaced with some indie rock flavor. But honestly, I caught some hints of the blues in a couple of the songs, most notably in the tune Go On. And on top of everything else, Michael has also amassed a very impressive collection of one-of-a-kind guitars. Michael Rubin, welcome to Time Signatures, my friend.
Howdy, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we are glad to have you, and we've got a lot of fun questions for you, so I hope you enjoy a challenge.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, man. Well, let's go ahead and just jump right off the deep end, man. What were the first memories of music for you? Any favorite tunes growing up?
Sure. So I actually have a funny story about how I got into playing guitar.
But sure.
The thing that got me into music before we get to guitar in general, pretty classic scenario. I listened to Pink Floyd's The Wall cover to cover with my dad, you know, in the dark on vinyl. I was 8 years old, so the only thing I was really missing was a joint. But again, I was 8 years old. So it's like, but you can imagine the scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, as like a little kid, some of those songs are kind of scary on that album.
Sure.
But you know, it just kind of made me feel a certain way. And I was like, wow, you know, if music could have this much art in it and just have this much to say, it'd be so much more interesting than all the other stuff I'm hearing on the radio now. So I was always like that, you know, weird contrarian kid who was like listening to Steely Dan when everybody else was listening to, like, I don't know, like Rihanna or whatever.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that, you know?
No, but, I mean, yeah, and again, nothing wrong with any sort of music that people listen to. Like,
right.
All music has its place, you know. However, just for me, it's always been rooted in the classic stuff, and
sure.
And everybody calls it dad rock now, which is pretty appropriate because it's all the rock that my pops used to listen to.
Right.
But it's good stuff, man. And if it wasn't good, it wouldn't still be top of the charts 50 years later. I mean, they had to make a separate chart just for classic rock because on
yes,
the rock
sir, they
charts,
did.
It was still Dark Side on top. It was still Led Zeppelin 3, you know, like it was still all the classic albums that everybody loves. So
absolutely. Well, I got to ask you now, because you've led up to that point, I've got to talk about the story of your addiction to Guitar Hero and how your father's teasing caused you to actually pick up a guitar and make a very grown-up decision at the age of 10, man. I need to hear the story.
Yeah, that's 100% true. That's exactly what happened. And that's the story of how I got into playing guitar. I played a whole lot of Guitar Hero when it came out. And you know what? Here's what I'll say about Guitar Hero. I think Guitar Hero was really important because there was a bit of a lull in the early 2000s of Guitar Heroes. I mean, mm-hmm. Think about in history, every decade had 1, 2, 3, 4, sometimes even more guys who were just iconic guitar players of the decade. You know, I mean, you've got all the guys in the 50s as well. 60s, you know, we've got I've too many to name in the 60s. And you know, 90s, you've got Kurt Cobain and you got all these different things happen. And then in the early 2000s, kind of there was nobody that I can immediately think of apart from the Foo Fighters. You know, I mean,
right.
Maybe I'm missing somebody, but it was kind of just Dave Grohl holding it down. After years of, like, I mean, guitar-centric music, there was kind of nothing. So Guitar Hero kind of put electric guitar back on the map for a lot of kids, probably myself included. And I spent, you know, a couple of months playing that game, and all it took was for my dad to come up to me and say, yo, why don't you stop being a loser, and how about you pick up a real guitar and, like, spend some time playing that, you know? And that was kind of it. I got a guitar for my birthday, and I never went back. I joined School of Rock as well.
Yeah.
And, that kind of – that was another thing, which, again, I think between Guitar Hero and School of Rock, any rock and roller that we see emerge in the next 10 years is going to be affected by one or both of those things, no question, because they're just had such a big impact on our culture. I mean, think about how many kids got exposed to rock and roll because of that.
Well, you know, we've got a School of Rock here in East Lansing, and I that's one of the things when I saw your background, I thought, man, I got to talk about this, because we've got some young people here in the greater Lansing area that are just blowing my mind. Got a 13-year-old drummer that's about 5 foot nothing, and he's just kicking butt up there. And then we got some guitar players up there and some singers. And I really think, this is just me, the School of Rock thing has been a boon for musicians, for the younger musicians coming up. And I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, 1 year at School of Rock is like 5 years anywhere else. It's like dog years there.
Wow.
And the biggest thing is that most people start by just playing by themselves. And when you just play by yourself, not to make this sound like an advertisement, but again, School of Rock's been a part of my life, so like I'm familiar with it. But, you know, when you just practice by yourself, you don't have that same motivation that you have to get there, that you have to be good,
right,
as when you practice in a group, right? So with School of Rockets, you have your one lesson every week, but then you know 3 days from now, 4 days from now, you're going to get together with all your bandmates, and if you don't know the song, that's on you, because everybody else is going to know the song. And on one side, there's like, you know, you can't screw that up, but on the other side, you have this amazing feeling of when you do nail it, you're like, holy crap, guys, we actually sound like a band. And after doing that for enough years, you start to feel like you can do it yourself. Now, then you get out into the harsh reality of the music business. And, you know, when everybody's parents don't come to the shows anymore, it's tough to keep filling out the venues every time you book a gig, you know.
Right,
and,
right.
And then making a career out of it. And then all the harsh realities that kind of come with doing this full time. But School of Rock gives you a way to experience all of that rigor kind of without having to worry so much about all the things that make it hard, you know, as stated, like bringing everybody to the show and, you know, coordinating everything and making sure all the gear works, making sure there's a sound guy and, like, I don't know, all the things that go with playing live.
Yeah. Well, you know, and looking at your notes here, it looks like you spent 6 years with the School of Rock, and that's an incredibly long time for a preteen or a teen to dedicate to anything, Mike. Talk about the level of dedication that you've maintained with your musical endeavors, and how old are you guys now? I mean, the guys in the band.
Sure. So I'm the youngest. I'm 24. Tom is the oldest. I think he's 28. And I think James just turned 27 a couple of days ago. So he's freshly around the same age as Tom, but they're a little older than me, but they're pretty close in age. I'm the younger one, and I want to talk about musical commitment with this man. I don't do anything else. I mean, this is my whole life. If I had to do a job application and they were like, what are your skills? If it's not playing guitar or being a front man or looking at guitars or talking about guitars, there ain't nothing else, man. That's kind of it. And, you know, there's a lot of things that you got to give up. You know, like I've definitely seen other people, like I know a couple guys who I went to school with that went into finance and they make, you know, crazy money and they live these crazy lives. And it's different because, you know, if that's what's important to you, then, hey, that's what's important to you. But as a musician, you know, you have this thing where, yes, you're an entrepreneur. And yes, it is kind of like building a business in a similar way. But the goal is different. It's not about becoming super rich and making all this money. It's about being able to do what you love. And if you can eat food and live somewhere, that's great. But more importantly, people give a crap about the art that you make. And that's really what it's about. So it's just kind of like, if you don't do this, all you're going to do is constantly think about doing this and how you could have done this and how you should have done this. So that's really the difference, is if you feel like you could step away from music and go do something else that's easier, and you'd be okay with that, I encourage you to do that, because it is a very hard road. But if you feel like, if you're a person who feels like if music wasn't in your life, then you'd have nothing else driving you, then you kind of have no choice, you know? So that's really what the difference is.
Talk about some sage advice from a guy in his mid-20s. That's pretty impressive. Mike, since Time Signatures is primarily a blues-based podcast, and we know that the blues has touched nearly every genre of music, I'd like you to talk about how your own music has been enhanced or touched by the blues.
Sure. Well, I mean, we could start off with the name King Falcon. I mean, think about the amount of blues players who have had the last name King.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can kind of just draw the influence right there. Personally, my favorite of them is Freddie King.
Okay.
I'm a huge Freddie King fan. But when I was learning guitar, so my guitar teacher, who, by the way, he got me into vintage guitars. He had a, and still has it, he had a 1961 Fender Strat, which was, it was stripped, so it was natural finish, and it had, I think it had an Alembic preamp built in. It was kind of hot rodded, but it was just the coolest guitar. And it was the first vintage guitar that I had ever seen that wasn't in a museum or like at the Hard Rock Cafe. It was the first one that somebody I knew had, and they handed it to me and they were like, yeah, play it. And, you know, like when you put on a pair of jeans that you've been wearing for a long time and they're nicely worn in, or
right,
like an old sweater that has been through a million wash cycles and it just feels right, like you don't have to break it in, that's what that guitar felt like. And I kind of got addicted to that, and I never really looked back. But anyway, side tangent there, obviously talking about guitars.
No, we're gonna, and I want you to know, we're gonna talk more about guitars here in a couple of minutes, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sure. I can't avoid it. It's just gonna come back. But his biggest influence was Albert King.
Okay.
And I remember the first video that he showed me was Albert King at 1971 at the Fillmore East, doing Blues Power.
Mm.
And I still go back and I watch that recording sometimes because it shows a couple things. Number one, we're so used to seeing Albert King as this already established guru, and he's like already the man. He's got opinions about everybody else. But for me, watching that, I see him as kind of a younger guy who is just like approaching the peak of his capability and of his popularity. And it's just like one of these last milestones where he's like proving himself by absolutely dominating a room full of people in just the most spectacular way. And his ability to be a band leader during that live performance is amazing. Everybody is watching what he's doing. And as he's telling that story about, you know, her boyfriend just bought a new GTO and she want to ride in every night. She's got the blues because her mama said no, you know, like he's just telling the story and you can hear a pin drop. It's just, you got that Leslie hanging out in the back and just like,
sure,
real cool drums. And then finally he comes in and he's just, I mean, he just makes the guitar cry. And what I love about it is he only does like the one bend, you know, that's the whole song. That's it. That's his whole thing. But every time you hear that, you're like, that's Albert King. And that's why when Stevie Ray Vaughan came around, everybody was like, well, he sounds just like Albert King. But that's because, you know, if you got some magic, you work with it. And for
right,
me, that is one of my top three live performances of all time. And I wish I could have been there. Like if I had a time machine, it would be Eric Johnson doing Cliffs of Dover. I think it was 1994, the one where he's wearing like the Napoleon jacket.
Mm-hmm.
The second one would be Gary Moore doing The Messiah Will Come Again at Montreux. And the third one would be 1971 Fillmore East, Albert King. And those I think would be like my three most legendary live guitar pieces of all time that I would want to see. And I know the first two are not quite bluesy, but you know, Albert King is amazing. And I did, speaking of the Kings, I did get to see BB King before he died, and that was amazing as well. Just
see,
I mean, even him sitting in that chair, he's just a big, big presence.
I'm thoroughly jealous of that. I've told the story on this program before that I sent my mom to see BB, but I did not go. I told her I would go next time. Well, there was not a next time. And I regret that decision every day since. By the way, you're listening to Time Signatures. I am your host, Jim Urban, and we are talking with Mike Rubin. He is with the band King Falcon. He is on the other end of our line today, and we're just having a blast talking about a little bit of everything. But Mike, as I was preparing for this interview, a particular factoid caught my eye, and I feel compelled to share it with you and get your comments. Now, listen to this. And this is from your press package. The announcement follows the release of the band's two recent singles, Ready, Set, Go and Cadillac, both of which have garnered an impressive attention, or have garnered impressive attention, now boasting over 500,000 streams each. Let that sink in for a minute. 500,000 streams for each song. Clearly, the music business has changed dramatically over the last 10, 15 years. But how did that make you feel to know that you had that many streams, Mike? Did you pinch yourself?
So I'll tell you what's funny about that is particularly Cadillac. Of all the songs on the record, all of them were pretty collaborative. Like, I would come in to the guys in the band and have a song that was kind of most of the way there. And then we'd go back and we rewrite parts of it and we work on stuff. And it was very much the three of us in the room together. Cadillac was very much my baby. Okay. I was really, like, I knew exactly how I wanted that song to be from the beginning. I made a GarageBand demo in my bedroom during COVID. my girlfriend was staying with me at the time, and I was working on that bass part. It must have been like 2 weeks that I was working on different ideas and different sounds of things. And all she heard was that do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, because she was in the next room. And at some point she comes in and she's like, I swear to God, I never want to hear that again. So like, I just, and even now at the show, she's like, I never want to hear that song again. I just heard it too much. But for me, having it go from being a stupid little demo in my computer to being something that 500,000 people have heard is kind of crazy. And I still think of it every time I hear that song. I still kind of hear the stupid demo version that I made. And I recorded the vocals when I was sick, so like my nose is all clogged, and I sound off. Not on the actual recording, but on the demo, which I do have, and at some point maybe we will release.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
yeah. So that's the version that I kind of still think of. And as far as your original question, it's just funny to think for me that's something that I made on my computer. Is now something that many people have listened to. It's just weird.
Wow. Now I've got to ask you about your fellow bandmates, because, you know, it wouldn't be fair if we spent all the time talking about you, because there is a band involved here, but I would like you to tell the story about how the band formed up, how it got together. And now, as you prepare and you're doing some actual touring and stuff, and a little bit of promotion, how are you guys doing together? Are you having a good time? You just blowing through everything, just enjoying it all?
Sure. So James and I have known each other for a really long time. Mm-hmm. I met James when I was like, I think I was like 12. I'm pretty bad at remembering exact years, but I think I was 12. And I think he was like 15, because he's a couple years older than me. Okay. We met because – so his I used to have a band called the Inoculated Canaries, which is a mouthful of a name. But again, I was 12, so like I'm surprised I even knew that word, but whatever. And we were short a drummer. So my uncle's friend was playing drums with us, and he's this old guy. He's probably, you know, 40 years old at the time. He played with us for a couple gigs, and then he had a kid, and he was like, hey, guys, this has been fun, but I'm going to go be a dad. Good luck finding a drummer. Maybe my nephew can help you out. Give him a call. So his nephew was James, and we had like a quote unquote audition. Mm-hmm. And the only person that showed up to the audition was James. So obviously he got the job, because we're like 12 years old and we're having this audition for somebody. Just the fact that he came in and like had a drum set was enough for him to get the part, you know? So we've been playing with him. I've been playing with him again. So that's like almost 12 years now. I mean, it's been half my life just about James and I have known each other. And in the Canaries, he was a drummer. So we started King Falcon because we kind of wanted to, you know, we had gotten older and we wanted to modernize a little bit and just kind of change the identity. But we didn't want to mess with the Inoculated Canaries, because the Canaries had sort of built a following. Sure. So we didn't want to just change the name and change the identity in case King Falcon didn't work out, but also because like we actually had some fans and they would be disappointed.
Right.
So we started King Falcon, and originally it was just a two piece. I was playing guitar and singing, obviously. And James was playing drums, and that was how we were going to roll. We recorded Shake, Shake, Shake that way. We recorded When the Party is Over that way. That's why the video is like that. Okay. And then, you know, we were kind of jamming and we were thinking about it. And we were like, it would be really a lot better if we had a third guy. Just because we like to experiment a little bit, we could do a little bit more musically. you know, there's more stage presence. Like, I have to sing and play guitar at the same time, so I'm a little bit stuck at the microphone sometimes.
Right.
Whoever's playing drums is obviously stuck behind the kit. So it's a very stationary show if you don't have a third guy who's, like, running around on stage. You know what I mean?
Right.
So we couldn't find a bass player, but we did know Tom because Tom was in another band that was touring, and he was a really, really talented musician. He was also a teacher at School of Rock, so we'd known him for a couple years. So James suggested that he move to bass, and we bring Tom in as a drummer, which is kind of crazy to think about because it's not often that a band member just says, well, screw it, I'll go play a different instrument. But that's exactly what happened. And James was more than happy to do it because James's real love is, number one, engineering sound, and number two, engineering the show. So he engineered our whole record. He got all those sounds, like all the mic choice and placement and actually capturing the recording. That was James. James also made our whole light show and all this cool stuff for stage. And he can only control that because he's not stuck behind a drum set anymore. So that actually unlocked a whole new world for him. And for us, it was great because we had already known Tom through the school and through the other band and kind of, so it just felt natural. And it's been that way for, I think, 2 years now with Tom.
Okay.
But King Falcon has been around for three, so we just have the first year without Tom. Every song on this record has the format of Tom, me, and James. This record is the three of us together, and we wrote all the songs together. And it's been a lot of fun, and touring has been really great. And our van has broken down a whole bunch. At some point, we're going to have to upgrade to a new van. But other than that, we've been very strong, and it's been nothing but fun.
Michael, as we wrap up here, I have to ask you and give you an opportunity to put your shingle out there. Where can we find out more about your band, buy some merch, maybe even book your band for a gig?
Sure. So we've got all the regular social media. So Instagram, we've got a Facebook, we've got a TikTok, we've got, I don't know, all the Twitter. We've got all that stuff. You can follow us on anything. If you want to buy some merch, which would be great, you can get it on our website, kingfalconband.com. We just got a whole bunch of very fresh new t-shirts. And the cool thing about reaching out to us, especially if you do it on our Instagram, you'll reach out to one of the guys in the band directly. So if somebody texts you back on the King Falcon Instagram, it's probably me, James, or Tom.
Nice, nice. Well, listen, this wraps up this edition of Time Signatures with Jim Irvin. Many thanks to our guest, Mike Rubin, and most of all to you, our listener. As we bring this episode to a close, please remember that our goal is to keep the blues alive, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time is our mission. We'll see you soon right here on Time Signatures.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby.
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.